Some of you may not have been here for all of our peregrinations through the Dharma in the last few weeks. The book group continues to read Norman Fisher's amazing book on the Lojong, which are a series of mind training exercises and reminders and pointers and general helpers for dealing with life. And I don't know if any of you have experienced this, but when I first encountered the Lojong, I saw a list of 59 slogans and 7 chapters and several very thick books on it, and it was a bit overwhelming. Pema Chodron, in her book Start Where You Are, helped a little bit make it less overwhelming, but I was still perplexed about how I was supposed to juggle 59 slogans in my daily activities. And it seemed like it was just a great big maze through which I was having a hard time getting through. Now, those of you who've been in the book group maybe have conquered all of those problems. But tonight I'd like to talk about a simple view of the Lojong. In fact, I'd like to try to get as simple as we can so that it becomes something understandable and completely manageable. Because then it starts to do its magic with us, which is the whole point. So, from 59 slogans, too many to memorize, many of them too difficult to understand, although Norman has done a great job with it in this book, making them understandable. We can take heart in the fact that the ancient people put it in 7 chapters, breaking it down into 7 groups. Actually, if you only read the first 4 chapters, you would be fine. And I'd like to distill that further to 5 points. Just 5 points to remember about the Lojong. Now, my wife Carol complains about my tendency to lump everything. And if this is lumping too many things together, then we can have some discussion afterwards. But here's an attempt. So, the essence of the Lojong begins with the first of 5 points being the preliminaries, which is the point that most people gloss over or view as something to be temporarily picked up and then put down again because we're no longer beginning students, now we're advanced students and we don't need preliminaries. But the preliminaries, as Norman points out, are this incredibly important thing, which I have burdened you with for my last 3 talks and a little bit more, if you'll allow me. The first point that Norman makes is one that I've never heard another teacher formally make. And that is the first of 3 parts of the preliminaries is our life to date. The incredible value that our entire life has had up until now, despite our many regrets, which we all carry, and our many wishes that we could go back and change something, our life as it has been lived. Mistakes and mess and disasters and catastrophes and all brought us in through that door and into this Sangha and into the study of the Dharma. And if you went back 10 years and changed one little thing, maybe you'd still be in that room, but maybe you wouldn't. And if you went back 30 years and changed one big thing, you would not be there today. And you would not be the same person today. So, this beautiful patchwork jigsaw puzzle of our life as messy as it has been, and as many regrets as we have about it, has served to bring us to the Dharma. It's a miracle. So we start this whole practice of Lojong realizing that through some incredible good fortune, we get to do this stuff. The second point that Norman makes, which not all teachers make, is that the second preliminary part of the preliminary is our daily meditation practice. Of course, a Zen teacher would say that, but he's pointing out that actually meditation is the cooking. In alchemy, the alchemists pictured a crucible, and you would put all the ingredients into the crucible and you would fire it, bring it up to red hot, and they would coalesce into gold or some other magical alchemical ingredient. Meditation is how we cook our experiences and the teachings and all of the Dharma, and we cook it into this miraculous thing that helps us wake up to the truth of who we are. Meditation is the cooking. And in fact, my teacher used to say something like, he said it in a variety of ways, but don't take the pot off the stove. Don't interrupt the cooking process. Don't let it get cold. Try to do meditation every day, whether you think it's good meditation or bad meditation or hopeless meditation or whatever. Sitting down, creating a little space of silence and stillness is the cooking. There is no bad meditation. And then the third of these first part, the preliminaries, the third preliminary, is the one we've been talking about the last few weeks, the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma. And this is best done by almost everybody at the beginning of your meditation session. The first few minutes of your daily meditation session is a formal contemplation of the four thoughts. I'm aware of the preciousness of this very life. I'm aware of the inevitability of change and death. I'm aware that all my activities of thought, word, and deed have consequence and can cause benefit or harm. And I'm aware that everybody suffers. Just that, letting each one have a little bit of time to percolate in. It really does have an alchemical effect. So these four contemplations performed daily are kind of like rototilling hard ground before you plant your garden. It grows better. Things work out better. Rototilling first is the work of the four thoughts. And if we take these four thoughts as a clump, they show us that on the Dharma path, things are not limited to the way they appear. And those of you who were with us all through the summer and fall realize that that was what we spent our summer and fall on. The teachings of emptiness, the beautiful book on the heart of understanding, which boils down to that understanding that the way things appear is not the way they actually are. And these four thoughts actually, without burdening us with the word emptiness, which freaks us all out, these four thoughts actually show us that on the Dharma path, things are not limited to the way they appear. For example, with the first thought, we think our lives are hard. We may think our lives are hard, or failed, or pointless, or any other little judgment we have about them. But we come to see that they are exquisitely rare and precious, our little lives. that brought us through that door. Exquisitely rare and precious. And that's a really good start at seeing that things aren't as they appear. This life that sometimes feels like we're totally messing it up is rare and precious enough to get us through that door. It's rare and precious enough to get us to support this amazing Sangha by our presence and our activities. It's rare and precious enough to get us to walk this Dharma path together, supporting each other on it. As far as the second thought, the inevitability of change and death, we go through life thinking we have time. We think we have enough time that we can put things off. But we come to feel the preciousness of each moment through these contemplations, the preciousness of each moment, but without any feeling of guilt or obligation. This isn't a puritanical exercise. We're not trying to guilt trip people through these slogans into trying to waste no time. It's just that as we start to appreciate the preciousness of every moment, we want to use every moment well to wake up, to relieve suffering. So no shoulds involved. And the third thought, that all of our activities have consequences, we might go through life thinking that we have little influence on others, that our lives don't matter for much. Our thoughts, words, and deeds are ours, and the world is big, and we're too little to really have any effect. But we learn that each one of our thoughts, each one of our words, each one of our deeds ripples out. It affects the field. And we start to see that we have the benefit, we have the ability with each thought, each word, each deed to affect the field in a good way or a bad way, in a healing way or in a more destructive way. And the fourth thought teaches us that things are not as they appear because we tend to be focused on our own little life and focused on our own little problems and victories. But with the fourth thought, we come to see that everybody suffers. As is said in AA, everyone is afraid. Everyone. And so our hearts are cracked open with the deepening of this realization. And we become very motivated to do no harm. And beyond that, we start to gain increasing motivation to relieve suffering in whatever of the miracle, many, many ways that we can. So those are the four thoughts, having this alchemical reaction before we even really think about it. It's a kind of subconscious transformation going on with those. Then the second of the five points that I think we can say summarize the Lojong, the first point being the three aspects of the preliminary practices, our life to date, our meditation, our contemplation of the four thoughts. Point two is absolute bodhicitta, absolute compassion. None of us know what this means, really. Absolute compassion is the ultimate truth that the Buddha discovered. And we are told again and again that there's no way to describe it. But it's put here, chapter two, absolute bodhicitta. And Norman, in his book, gives a beautiful little example, some beautiful explanations of why we have to have some grasp of where we're heading for us to make sense of the Lojong that follows, to put it in context. And so Pema Chodron tried to not get us to rake our heads open thinking about it. She just said, have some sense of this vast openness, loving openness, and then kind of flash it before you start working with Tonglen. So before each Tonglen session, she said, flash absolute bodhicitta. I have to admit to you that I found that instruction very unhelpful. I could never make sense of it. But over time, I started to realize that this absolute bodhicitta is related to the fundamental teaching in Buddhism, the teachings on emptiness, that the heart of understanding was trying to point out to us. And so as we progress in understanding absolute bodhicitta, actually not understanding it, experiencing it, we're assured that we develop on the, as we develop on the path, we start to taste this vast openness and this vast oneness that is the truth of emptiness. And this leads us to a form of selfless compassion, which is very different from sympathy. It's a form of selfless compassion that kind of explains the whole Dharma path without words. And the main reason for putting absolute bodhicitta here at the beginning of the slogans is that it assures us, again, not in so many words, but it assures us that we can come to know with unshakable faith that the Dharma is all about love. The Dharma path is all about love. Selfless, vast love. And as we practice and we start to have tastes of non-separation, tastes of oneness, where you start to actually get little teeny glimmers of the fact that you and that other person are not separate beings, you are one, then compassion becomes something very different than anything we've ever thought before. And love becomes the way of living, I guess is one way to say it. And then the four immeasurables, these experiences that people report as they approach awakening, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, show themselves to be this part of this vastness, this undefinable unity almost of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And this first point, the second point, absolute bodhicitta, is trying to say to us, look, this is why we do the Lojong. And this is the context in which the Lojong is actually done, even though we don't get it yet. And the Lojong leads us back to it. So this is, our Buddha nature is influencing our Lojong practice, even though we don't really understand or experience our Buddha nature completely yet. And then the Lojong helps us to approach understanding of our Buddha nature. So it's two-way. It's working at us at the beginning, and it's working on us from the other end. But as all the teachings on the Lojong say, don't beat yourself up about trying to understand absolute bodhicitta. You can't. It's just this kind of taste of where this is all taking us and how it all fits together. I've told many of you that my teacher's teacher called such a teaching in his very broken Tibetan English, he said, target pointing or target showing. He's showing us where we're heading, even though nobody in the room really gets it. He said, don't worry, it's just pointing out the target, pointing out where we're going. So then we can move in point three of the 5 points of understanding the Lojong. By the way, this is just my own made-up system. So don't take it as gospel and don't feel that you need to agree with it. But these 5 points are the way I understand the Lojong and make it manageable for myself. So then the third point is relative bodhicitta. And even if you read nothing else in this book, reading Norman's chapter 3 on relative bodhicitta is worth doing. The daily nitty-gritty, never-ending work of dealing with real people rather than concepts and ideals. The kind of work none of us really want to do most of the time. It's fun to think about working with real people, and often shortly after starting, we'd rather go home and take a nap. Relative bodhicitta is the working with real people in real situations. People who are likely to irritate us as we irritate them. All of the messy stuff. As Pema Chodron says, all of the juicy stuff. So the tool we do this with is Tonglen, which Linda's been reviewing with you. Tonglen, as you have come to learn, works both ways. You can do Tonglen for others, starting with their catastrophes and problems and messy emotions. Or you can start with yourself, waking up at midnight with some terrible thought or emotion that's going to keep you awake the rest of the night. And then you reorient yourself to your toolbox and you pick up Tonglen for self and you breathe that in. Your own emotion that'll keep you up all night, you actually pick that up and you bring it into your heart. And there's a point here that the Tibetans talk about, which sounds like magical thinking, but actually can really help at midnight or 3 a.m. This sense that by my holding this pain, maybe somebody else won't feel it as acutely. So there's that little sense that maybe by my consciously picking up this messy emotion and consciously placing it in my heart, owning it and holding it, maybe somebody else will be a little bit relieved of a similar emotion. Whether you believe that or not, sometimes at 3 a.m. that helps. Then you use the Tonglen approach of transforming it into healing, soothing light energy, and you send it out to others. It's a wonderful practice in the middle of the night when you're being tormented by demons. You bring those in and send out light. Or the opposite, taking in other people's demons and transforming them and breathing out light to them. That was point 3, all about relative bodhicitta and the tool of Tonglen. Point 4 is transforming bad circumstances into the path. Working with everything that arises. We talked about it last year, summer and fall, as the 5 certainties. The certainty that everything is your teacher. The perfect teacher at the perfect time and the perfect place with the perfect form of the teaching for the perfect recipient. Everything that arises can be used as your most powerful tool of that moment on the path. Everything that arises is your practice. Everything that arises is your teacher. Nothing left out. If, as you do the Tonglen, this starts to become second nature. Sometimes you don't want it to be second nature. Sometimes you'd rather have good normal aversion, and you're welcome to it. But then you can come back to realizing that this is actually a potential teaching. Again, no shoulds, no guilt trips, no musts, no commandments, just an opportunity. And point 4 is super important. Transforming bad circumstances into the path. This is actually the heart of Vajrayana Buddhism. The path becomes everything that life presents you. The teachings are everything life presents you. The practice is everything life presents you. Everything life presents you can be part of your path to awakening. Nothing left out. And when you get fed up with looking at life that way, then go to a party and have some fun and come back some other time. But this is a really important part of the path, and it's put here in point four because the Lojong really is taking us there. Everything that happens is your precious teacher. And then point five, which involves all the other slogans in the book, is making the practice your whole life. And all the rest of the slogans in the book, I haven't counted how many there are when you get through those first ones, but there's a lot of slogans having to do with relationship and the messiness of life in general. And you don't need to memorize them. I wouldn't try. But they're there, and there's a couple of ways of working with that that are pretty cool. One way is to just once in a while read through the list and something will jump out at you, and you can investigate it and see if it's a tool that you'd like to use for a while, for a few weeks or a few months or whatever. By the way, that's the way we work with the slogans and all these other four points. We choose a few in each point that one or even one that makes sense to us and work with one slogan. So, you know, going back to where we were, you can work with one absolute bodhicitta slogan. View everything as a dream. And really work it. You can be amazed at what can come from that. Same with the relative bodhicitta. Or you can just stick with Tonglen, because that's one of the slogans. Actually, several of the slogans relate to Tonglen. The point four, transform bad circumstances into path. There's quite a few slogans there to choose from. Choose one this year, work with another one next year. It's really how you want to do it. But there's a lot there. And same with all the rest of the slogans of how to make practice your whole life. Everything becomes Dharma practice. There is a way of buying a set of Lojong cards from, I think it's from Shambhala. I think I've seen them on Amazon. Lojong cards. Carol and I use them. You can put them in a little picture stand, and each card has a slogan on the front and on the back an explanation of it. And so each day or each week you can pull out another slogan at random and have that the one that's sitting there on your bookcase. But that's a cool way of working with these slogans too. And once in a while, one will capture your attention enough that you'll want to focus on it and use it for a while, weeks or months. So we've taken 59 slogans and 7 chapters and put them into 5 points, which is just one way of doing it. And if it's helpful to you, then organize your understanding of the Lojong that way, or come up with your own, even better. So all last year, from June till October, we talked about the view of emptiness in Thich Nhat Hanh's book. But at the end, I said, really, if you don't like to read, just try to read the 5 or 6 pages that encompass chapter 1 and chapter 2. Interbeing and empty of what? 5 or 6 pages at most. And that is enough for that book. And then for this book, I would say, if you don't like to read, just read chapters 1 through 4. It's a little bit more of a reading assignment than it was for Thich Nhat Hanh, but I think you'll find a lot of value in that. And don't worry about the rest. Or pick it up next year or some other year when you feel like it. But keep in mind that all of this is leading us to the key point, which is that the Dharma is all about love, all about love. So all of our practices and all of our studies are ultimately all about love. Another point before I finish here is just to remind you that you've heard this a lot, but the Dharma practice, the Dharma path, is not concerned at all with results. It's concerned with practice, with falling down and picking ourselves up again, and trying something new and tripping and getting up again. It's a process, no end point. I've met people who struck me as being very realized beings, and they were still exploring the Dharma path and still learning more from it. So practice and training are much more important than any idea of gaining results, which is one of the slogans. Abandon all hope of fruition. Just keep going. And that covers it tonight. I think that's enough talking. I'd be happy to entertain any discussion or observations or questions or anything. There's a lot going on with this subject, but it's basically that simple. And you don't have to have questions either. Please don't feel on the spot. Just if you have observations or want to talk about your own experience with working with any of these, might be helpful to the group. Well, we could meditate instead of talking. Well, that's okay. We're in a fairly traumatic time in our political history, and everyone is affected. And we're also dealing with a subject which is pretty deep. The Lojong is really a key part of the Dharma path. At least has a lot of potential for helping us. But it's a lot to take in, and it takes a long time to play with. Hopefully, if you're lucky, you'll still be exploring and experimenting with the Lojong for years to come, for the rest of your life. And sometimes you'll put it down and pick it back up. But it's likely that if you've given it much of a focus, some of these slogans will travel with you in your life to come, in all of what's going to be happening. And if you just took one slogan from the book, you would find that over time, your understanding of it would change so much that it's kind of like a different tool than the one you first picked up. So make it your own. In fact, this is true with every Dharma teaching and every Dharma practice. Make it your own. Give it the benefit of the doubt. Try it out. Try it on. See how it fits. Pick it up in various situations and put it down in others, but give it a chance. And then if it's not the right teaching or practice for you, don't worry about it. The reason that there are a kajillion Dharma teachings is that everyone is different, and everyone is different from one month to the next. And so from one month to the next, different Dharma teachings help us. And meanwhile, even our closest friends might be picking up another Dharma teaching that's helping them. So we're all different. We all use these tools differently. I really like thinking of these Dharma teachings as tools in a big toolbox that we carry around. And in different circumstances, we pick out a different tool. And for a while, we get really enamored with one tool and use it in a wide range of circumstances. And then eventually, we pick up another one and find it more useful because we've changed. And the circumstances of our life have changed. So the Dharma path is about a certain amount of playfulness. There's the seriousness of being diligent and trying to do no harm. And there's the playfulness of trying these things on and trying them out and seeing what fits where and seeing which practices we can make our own and which we set aside and just realize those particular ones aren't for us. So feel really open about that. And at the same time, watch your mind. Watch your mind as far as what you add. Many of us have the habitual tendency of adding self-criticism, self-doubt, self-loathing, undermining ourselves. So it's really important on every step of the Dharma path, no matter which Dharma tool you're using, to also use the mirror to watch what you're adding. To watch when you say about a meditation session, oh, that wasn't a good meditation session, or oh, I'm not a good meditator, or I can't do that, or I'm no good at this. Those are completely adventitious obstacles. They are just the color paint you're putting on reality at that moment and distorting it out of habit. So watch that and don't beat yourself up when you catch yourself doing it. Just notice, I'm coloring reality with low self-esteem or with self-criticism or with fatalism or whatever. Because we all do it all the time, so it's important to, on the path of awakening, become more conscious of what we're doing. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Nancy, you are a total blur. Oh, there you are. There you go. At first, I thought that Jenna had just changed clothes a little bit. I can't hear you. Well, you know, you're blurred, but I can hear you. I don't understand why we're getting a blurry picture, but that's okay. I can live with it. I can. Not real loud, but let me just turn up my own volume here. That'll help. Okay. I'm ready. Okay.
So, in my life, I live at the computer most of the day, and I'm the beneficiary of getting the whole news flash almost instantly. Now, what's going on in DC? And so today, the consequence of my blessed instantly is that EPA is now driving out.
Yes. Yeah, I think you gave us a beautiful description. I think that it's important to always keep the perspective that in everything we're dealing with the two truths. The absolute truth, which has to do with the view of emptiness and oneness and love and compassion, which is true. But also the relative truth, which is that sometimes we face obstacles, sometimes we face evil, and we hold both truths. We keep the view of emptiness and of compassion and the four immeasurables, and we act. And we try to act doing no harm. And that is the ultimate koan, which you will never completely solve, but holding these two truths, you keep trying to get closer to some balance between, on the one hand, seeing everything as your teacher, taking it on the path, learning what you can, doing no harm, and on the other hand, resisting injustice and protecting the weak and powerless, and fighting oppression and injustice, but doing it differently than the riots and the Molotov cocktails and the broken windows and shop fronts, you know? So it's, again, this is what Pema Chodron calls the messy stuff, the juicy stuff. We embark on it knowing we can't get it right. We're just constantly trying to come closer to this balance as we try something and realize, no, maybe that was an overshoot toward the absolute and made us too passive and airy and la la, and then make another attempt and maybe we're overshooting on the other side and getting close to throwing a Molotov cocktail at something, you know? I am not any font of wisdom about what we should do, or actually how you can get it right. It's just that these are the guidelines we're trying to hold. The big view and the immediate view. The view of love and compassion and non-harming, and the view of resisting evil and injustice. And just holding those two keeps us more conscious in our decisions and our actions. It doesn't guarantee we get it right. It doesn't guarantee that we won't make mistakes. It actually kind of guarantees we will constantly make mistakes. But at least we're conscious and we're trying to get closer to the truth as we do what must be done by all beings to fight injustice. I don't know whether that's a satisfying response or not. Absolutely. Yeah. And we don't get it right. But we have examples. Examples have been sent us. Mother Teresa in Calcutta, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Jesus. You know, we have examples of people who have shown us how they try to balance these things. Gandhi's an amazing example. fighting injustice nonviolently. God, I mean, it almost boggles the mind to think about it, and he did it. Yeah, and his teachings on ahimsa are very relevant today. Yes, Joanna's a great one. I knew I was leaving one of our most important heroes out. Thank you. Oh, it is. It is. And I believe in Joanna Macy's private universe, she's been in this hard time a long time. So she's a good example. She's been seeing things that most of us haven't been looking at for 40 years at least, and fighting this struggle in the way that I view as a model fight. So Joanna and Martin Luther King and Gandhi come closest in my own view, but that's just mine. I relate to them as getting it a little bit more right than most people. Thanks for bringing that up. It's really important that we don't give the idea that the Dharma is all airy-fairy and make nice and all of that. Actually, the Dharma has nothing to do with being nice. That's really important to understand. This is not about making nice. It's about the truth. And the truth is finding the middle way between absolute truth and relative truth, including them both, holding them both, finding action. And that's not about being nice. Right. Thank you. I think the best example of how this isn't about being nice is an example from motherhood. You know, when your child wants to eat the whole box of jelly donuts and you have to say no, or the times that you have to discipline a child. The child says, "You're not nice." And the mom says, "You're right." You know, I'm not going to be nice if that means letting you eat 12 jelly donuts. So it's not about being our idea of holy people, because that idea is worthless. It's about finding this constantly moving target between the ideals of vast, open, loving compassion and the reality of having to stand up to evil and injustice. And the proper way to do it is different for each of you. And it doesn't mean you have to do something dramatic. As Kipling said, they also serve who simply stand and wait. They also serve who meditate in the caves and the mountains. They actually are creating and holding a field which affects us all. So there's a million ways of doing it. You can do it by being a hermit meditating in a cave, or you can do it by being a Gandhi or a Joanna Macy. It's an individual thing, but they're all doing it. The Hopis actually subscribed to that sense of the people in the cave keeping our world from blowing itself up. Those who meditate in the cave being the glue that holds us together. The Hopis Some of you have heard this before. Were visited by Carl Jung back in the 30s. Carl Jung went out to one of the pueblos and sat in the medicine lodge and practiced with the elders, and then said, "Tell me, what is this practice all about? What are you doing in this kiva, practicing and chanting?" And the Hopi elder said, "Well, we like you, so we can tell you that this is what keeps the sun coming up in the morning." "Not everybody knows that," they said, "but we're going to tell you." So we can also look at our own practice as keeping the sun coming up in the morning. Thank you so much. It's just wonderful to be with you. There's the absolute, there's the relative, and there's the virtual. The three truths. Okay. Love you guys.